The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop, looking out over London.
Good night, and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs. Will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
All right. Welcome to a Wednesday. I am Nicole Sandler at NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network, along with other outlets that kindly carry the program or a podcast near you. However you listen, I thank you for doing so. Today, the intro that news, the importance of the news media intro really hits home, because we're going to talk a bit about real news. There is fake news out there. There's lots of it. But it's opposite world. You know, I talk about fake news. Well, I talk about opposite world all the time. You know, opposite world.
Everything you thought you knew, you never knew it all. Sideways is straight ahead. Facts no longer matter. Reality is now fiction. There's a signpost up ahead. Your next stop, opposite world.
We have a president who constantly talks about fake news, except he ascribes it to the mainstream media that does occasionally get stuff wrong, but their goal is not to make shit up, as Fox does, or as a newer arrival on the scene does, a group called Sinclair Broadcasting. And I'm not going to get too into it now, because our guest today is Richard R.J. Eskow, who has a new piece up. It starts at ourfuture.org, which is where he blogs, but it's made the rounds to Alternet and Crooks and Liars and a bunch of other places. And it's really important that everybody understand who Sinclair Broadcasting is and what it is that they are attempting to do. So we'll get into that. But it has to do with the Fourth Estate and the importance of a fair and free press. And we have a president who's doing everything in his power to upend that notion. And it's the fourth branch of government. I mean, that's what the whole notion behind the Fourth Estate is. And it's being dismissed as something other than the necessity that it is. So we'll get into that in a bit. Believe it or not, this has been kind of a slow news week. I know that it's unthinkable to even say that. There's stuff going on. Of course, over the weekend we had the March for Our Lives and the 60 Minutes Stormy Daniels interview. But in terms of hard news stories, it's been kind of quiet. Trump hasn't had a public event on his calendar in 5 days now. He hasn't responded to the Stormy Daniels story, although his people claim that he has. Yeah. Sarah Sanders keeps saying, look, you know, have you noticed how she starts every answer with look, 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 he's talked about that. He's said that, he's denied, however she puts it. Anyway, he hasn't. He has not weighed in on Stormy Daniels at all, despite their protestations to the contrary. His tweet proclaiming that the Second Amendment will never be overturned was aimed at a New York Times editorial by former Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens, not the Parkland kids, who aren't advocating for that at all. I might be, but they're not. But there have been no more staff turnovers at the White House this week. Just rumors of that wife beater Rob Porter's possible return, seriously, and the usual coming end of John Kelly, the Veterans Affairs guy Shulkin, Ben Carson at HUD. You know, there's lots of rumors, but as for hard news stories, it's been quiet, making me even more tense than usual, wondering what, you know, what the other shoe is that's about to drop. We keep hearing that Trump can't find any attorneys from so-called white shoe law firms to join the team representing him on the Russia probe. By the way, I looked up white shoe law firms because I had no idea what it meant. And what it means is white shoe firm is a phrase used to describe leading professional services firms in the U.S., particularly firms that have been in existence for more than a century and represent Fortune 500 companies. So when they're talking about a law firm, they're talking about one that's been around for a long time and has, you know, high-powered and important clientele. So poor Donald can't get any of them to sign on to his case. Go figure. The response from the Trump camp is that there's nothing to see here. Just, you know, move right along. There is news, however, and with that, we bring you to today's What's News, which, I'll attempt to do live, seeing that the voice seems to be holding up so far so good today.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Here's a big story. This just broke within the last hour or so. A district court judge has ruled that the emoluments case against Donald Trump can move forward. According to Bloomberg, Judge Peter Messett in Greenbelt, Maryland, rejected the Justice Department's argument to dismiss the lawsuit. The ruling was a huge blow for Trump, who swears there are no conflicts of interests and no violations of the Constitution's emoluments clauses. Detractors say, however, that world leaders and influential political organizations and leaders are actively using the Trump Hotel near the White House in a way that helps the Trump family profit. The ruling marks the first time that a lawsuit of this kind has cleared the initial legal hurdle, a finding that the plaintiffs have legal standing to sue the president in the first place. So that's pretty huge. The case is one of three brought by the watchdog group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, also known as CREW. Well, it after rumors and lots of speculation, we find out it's true. North Korea's Kim Jong-un visited China in Kim's first trip out of his country since he assumed power in 2011. According to Chinese officials who he met with, Kim promised to denuclearize North Korea. I'm just reading what it says. Although North Korea's official statement about the trip made no mention of denuclearization, China's foreign ministry released a lengthy statement containing what it claims are direct quotes from Kim Jong-un pledging to get rid of his nuclear weapons. Quote, "It is our consistent stand to be committed to denuclearization on the peninsula in accordance with the will of the late President Kim Il-sung and late General Secretary Kim Jong-il." This is what Kim Jong-un is quoted as saying. It continues, "The issue of denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula can be resolved if South Korea and the United States respond to our efforts with goodwill, create an atmosphere of peace and stability while taking progressive and synchronous measures for the realization of peace." Stay tuned is all I can say. I'll believe it when I see it. At least a dozen states are suing the Trump administration over its decision to add a question to the 2020 census asking respondents if they are U.S. citizens. This from CNN.
"We're not going to stop. And we're going to defend every one of our rights to make sure that every one of our people who's worked hard to make California the sixth largest economy in the state is counted."
California's attorney general suing the Trump administration over that count. The U.S. Census, the form you fill out, making sure the country has an accurate count of the people who live here. The Justice Department requesting a seemingly simple question be asked, asking, "Are you a U.S. citizen?" California says it's much more than that, at the heart designed to cheat this anti-Trump state.
"It literally diminishes our voice in our federal government and compromises our fair representation that's called for in the Constitution and in federal law. That's exactly what's at stake here."
In California, undocumented immigrants make up nearly 2 to 3 million people. And in the Trump presidency, fear in those communities has grown. Trump giving more teeth to immigration enforcement. Under Trump, arrests of non-criminal immigrants more than doubled in 2017 as compared to the year before. California's lawmakers say that deters undocumented immigrants from declaring their status on any document. Fewer people counted in California, fewer federal dollars and potentially fewer representatives in Congress. The Trump re-election campaign endorsed the DOJ's move. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, in a letter reinstating the citizenship question on the 2020 census, writes, "For the approximately 90% of the population who are citizens, this question is no additional imposition."
From the just when you thought a news story couldn't get any worse or any more disgusting comes this one. William Strampel, former dean of Michigan State University's College of Osteopathic Medicine and the boss of Larry Nassar, was arrested on Monday for using his office to, quote, harass, discriminate, demean, sexually proposition, and sexually assault female students, according to the Michigan Attorney General's office.
It was the boss of Larry Nassar, the doctor here at MSU, the Olympic physician for all the gymnasts in this country. And what happened is that it was this doctor who actually stood up for Larry Nassar in the Title IX complaint in 2014 and said it was a medical procedure. He wasn't sexually assaulting young women. And that doctor is what allowed MSU to say it was an approved procedure and he kept assaulting young women. One of the things that just stands out from the criminal complaint filed today is criminal sexual conduct. And according to the affidavit of probable cause, four young women, all female, all medical students, say that Dr. William Strampel actually groped them, propositioned them, told them, if you do me a favor, I'll do you a favor, gave them comments that they needed to dress in a more sexy manner. And the details are just striking. Additionally, we learned some background today from the special prosecutor, William Forsythe, with the Michigan Attorney General's office, that they received a tip in February. And that tip made them act quickly. And they executed a search warrant right here at Michigan State University to get Dr. Strample's computer, electronic equipment. And one of the charges here also in regard to the misconduct has to do with pornography of women that was found on his computers, images, some of them appearing to be selfies. Most of them, we were told, have to do with Michigan State University students, and also videos. Pornography on his computer, 37,000 images of child porn on Larry Nassar's computer.
Absolutely sickening. Again, just when you thought it couldn't get any worse. Stormy Daniels' attorney is asking a federal judge in California for permission to depose the president and his longtime lawyer, Michael Cohen, about the nondisclosure agreement the porn actress says she signed to keep quiet about her alleged affair with Trump. In documents filed early this morning, Michael Avenatti said he was seeking to depose Trump and Cohen for no more than 2 hours each to find out whether Trump was aware of the agreement and whether he consented to it. Daniels' attorney, Avenatti, was on CBS This Morning today to talk about his motion to depose Trump.
I've heard this motion described as brilliant, brazen, and frankly, crazy. So what exactly are you looking for here?
Well, the motion is not crazy. I mean, we're relying on U.S. Supreme Court precedent and a whole long line of cases in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal. It is well-founded. It was well thought out. It's incredibly documented.
What do you want?
We want the truth. I mean, we want to know the truth about what the president knew, when he knew it, and what he did about it. As it relates to this agreement, we're going to test the veracity or the truthfulness of Mr. Cohen's, his attorney's, statements. And we're confident, Gail, that when we get to the bottom of this, we're going to prove to the American people that they have been told a bucket of lies.
The motion references a meeting on March 21st. What happened at that meeting?
We had what's called a meet and confer, where both sides confer about impending motions. We raised this motion with the other side, and I think one of the things that was significant during that meeting was we asked Mr. Harder, Mr. Trump's attorney, whether Mr. Trump was a party to this agreement, and we heard crickets. They don't know. He said they don't know yet whether Mr. Trump was a party to this agreement. How do you not know whether you're a party to an agreement unless you're just trying to make it up as you go along?
You're essentially arguing this is bigger than Stormy Daniels now, that this essentially agreement was an effort to influence the 2016 election. What would the judge need to be convinced of in order to grant your request in order to have a deposition of the president?
We don't think it's a big stretch. The other side is attempting to force this case into a private arbitration hidden from the public where the public doesn't learn what really happened. In order for the judge to determine that, we are arguing that under the law, we're entitled to the deposition. Quite honestly, there was a mistake by the other side in pushing this case into federal court, and now we're going to bring it to bear.
The president, who repeatedly insisted during the campaign that Mexico would pay for a wall along the southern border, is privately pushing the U.S. military to fund construction. Really, I couldn't make this one up.
Oh, we'll build a wall. Don't worry. We will build. I promise. We're building the wall. And Mexico will pay for the wall. I promise.
Well, that was President Trump on Election Eve 2016 saying that Mexico would pay for the wall. These days, though, it looks like the military may have to foot the bill. According to the Washington Post, Trump, quote, is privately pushing the U.S. military to fund construction of his signature project, suggesting the Pentagon could fund the sprawling construction, citing a national security risk. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders dodged questions about that topic earlier today.
Does he mean that he wants the military to pay for the border wall? Can you speak generally to that?
Again, I'm not going to get into the specifics of that, but I can tell you that the wall is continuing to be built currently, and we're going to keep pushing forward until it's fully completed in the way that the president feels is necessary to defend the country.
And isn't it true at this point that Mexico is just not going to pay for that wall?
I'm not going to go beyond what the president's already said. I think he still has plans to look at potential ways for that to happen.
Yeah, potential ways for that to happen. My ask. Okay, one last story. And this from Rachel Maddow. I tried to tighten her up a bit because she does tend to ramble on. But she does tell the story how a group of Senate Democrats are trying to protect Robert Mueller. Again, one story we keep hearing or rumors of a story we keep hearing is that Trump is going to fire Mueller. Well, there are some Senate Democrats who are working to keep that from happening.
Nine Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee have just written to the whole line of succession at the U.S. Justice Department, asking five officials in the line of succession to make the same kind of commitment to protect the Mueller investigation and the Russia scandal that Elliot Richardson and William Ruckelshaus did to protect the Watergate prosecutor back in 1973. The person at the Justice Department who oversees the Mueller investigation is, of course, Rod Rosenstein. He has already made this kind of public commitment.
If you were ordered today to fire Mr. Mueller, what would you do?
So I've explained previously, I would follow the regulation. If there were good cause, I would act. If there were no good cause, I would not.
If there were no good cause, I would not act. I would not follow that order. Well, if the president fires Rod Rosenstein, though, the line of succession in terms of oversight of the Mueller investigation would go from him to the Solicitor General, Noel Francisco, and then to the Assistant Attorney General for the Office of Legal Counsel, Stephen Engel, and then to the head of the National Security Division of the Justice Department, John Demers. And then it would go to two specific U.S. attorneys. First, the U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of North Carolina, who is Bobby Higdon, and then to another U.S. attorney in Texas, Aaron Neely Cox. These nine senators tonight have now written to this whole line of succession. And this is what they said, quote, we have significant concerns that the president or his White House could order individuals at the Department of Justice with the authority to oversee special counsel Mueller's probe to interfere with the probe or shut it down. You fall in the line of succession at the Department of Justice if Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein were to either resign or be removed. We right now to request that you provide a written and public commitment that you will not interfere in the special counsel's investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 elections, possible collusion with such meddling by the Trump campaign, efforts to obstruct justice, or any related inquiry. As such, we ask that you publicly commit to refuse any order or request, whether express or implied, to interfere in the special counsel's investigation, including but not limited to firing Mr. Mueller, cutting off funding or resources, limiting staffing, or inhibiting his ability to follow the facts wherever they may lead.
Will it work? I don't know. I guess your guess is as good as mine. We wait and see. And that's a bit of what's news for now. We'll take a quick time out. We'll check in with Brad and Desi in the Green News Report and come back with Richard R.J. Eskow next to talk about Sinclair Broadcasting and why you need to know who they are. Stay tuned. I'm Nicole Sandler at NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The implications of living in the nation's oil and gas capital became all too clear after Hurricane Harvey slammed Houston last August.
Hurricane Harvey's toxic legacy, much worse than publicly revealed.
EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt gives another gift to the auto industry. Plus,
I will never sign another bill like this again. I'm not going to do it again.
Massive omnibus bill has good news for national parks, firefighting, and a tiny village in Alaska.
All of that surprising good news and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
This is all you really need to know about climate change. Number one, it's real. Number two, man-made emissions caused it. And number three, that's why women need to rule the world.
Man slam. This is your Green News Report.
I'm sick of cleaning up after you guys.
Okay, Desi Doyen, so the Hurricane Harvey response wasn't quite as impressive as Donald Trump pretended?
Yeah, that's definitely the case. 6 months after Hurricane Harvey hit Houston, Texas, and shattered the record for the largest single deluge ever recorded in U.S. history, a massive study of county, state, and federal records conducted by the Associated Press and the Houston Chronicle has found that Harvey had a much more widespread toxic impact than has been previously made public. The reporters cataloged more than 100 releases of more than a dozen toxic chemicals and carcinogens that were released into neighborhoods and waterways. Yet officials at the time assured the public that the post-storm pollution posed little to no health threat. The analysis found only a handful of these industrial spills have been investigated by federal regulators, and state regulators have taken no enforcement actions at all for these toxic releases. Meanwhile, a heads up, Bloomberg News reports that Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt will soon begin the formal process of aggressively weakening fuel economy standards that were set under the Obama administration. This would be for new vehicles starting in 2022 and to which automakers had already agreed to do back in 2012.
I guess this is because Trump voters enjoy paying more for their gas?
Yes, apparently so. These standards would have decreased air pollution and greenhouse gas emissions and saved consumers money, but now they won't, thanks to intense lobbying from the U.S. auto industry. And Pruitt also indicated that he may try to strip the state of California of its special waiver to maintain tougher air pollution standards under the Clean Air Act, which a number of states have also adopted.
California is not, you know, the arbiter of these issues. The EPA, the DOT, and others make those decisions. California contributes as well, but that shouldn't and can't dictate to the rest of the country what these levels are going to be.
I feel like I remember this story, have seen it before. This is what happened when the George W. Bush administration came in and they challenged California's more stringent environmental protection standards, and they won at the time in the Supreme Court. We finally turned that back, but now it looks like the same old fight again.
That is exactly what happened in the past, and it looks like the federal government now is going to participate in switching the rules back and forth and back and forth again.
And if you have any questions about this, go see the movie Who Killed the Electric Car? We had an electric car way back in the 90s called the EV1 that everybody liked who had one, and the Bush administration helped kill that. And, well, everything old and stupid is new and being done all over again, I guess.
Meanwhile, Trump's Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke has launched a new outdoor recreation advisory panel to make recommendations on public lands policy, and he's stocked it with industry representatives who have a financial interest in public lands. Washington Post reports that many of the 16 members of the new committee come from the motorized recreation vehicle industry. Other members have advocated for privatizing park services, while others represent companies with National Park Service contracts. Not on the advisory panel are anyone from the Outdoor Industry Association, which advocates for non-motorized activities like hiking and kayaking. But finally, some good news. The massive $1.3 trillion omnibus bill that President Trump signed last week over his own objections not only retains the current budget of the EPA and retains clean energy policies as is, It also includes a big boost to the budget of the National Park Service to make much-needed infrastructure repairs. Also, a boost for the Forest Service's firefighting and fire prevention budget, which has long been sought by conservation and forestry groups in the wake of record wildfire seasons across the nation. Also in the omnibus bill, and also very good news, a tiny town in Alaska that is threatened by climate change has finally received some federal funding to relocate. The small village of Newtok, Alaska, has been losing 70 feet of land every year due to sea level rise and coastal erosion. Congress has now appropriated $15 million to begin relocating Newtok to a safer location 9 miles inland. It's only a fraction of what's required to relocate the whole village, but it's a start.
I'll take it. For much more on all of those reports and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Dreams can come true again when everything old is new again.
And now, back to Nicole on Progressive Voices and NicoleSandler.com.
We are back. Richard Esko is host of The Zero Hour at thisisthezerohour.com. He writes regularly at ourfuture.org. You can find him on Twitter at RJ Esko. Hello, Richard Esko.
Hello, Nicole Sandler.
Thank you so much for joining me today. And I really wanted to talk with you about, I always welcome the opportunity to talk with you about just about anything. But you wrote a piece about Sinclair Broadcasting that I think is so important for people to understand what's going on with our media. So thank you for writing that piece, first of all, and thank you for joining us today.
Sure, my pleasure.
I guess we should start with what is Sinclair Broadcasting and why am I sounding such a heavy alarm?
Well, Sinclair Broadcasting Group is a corporation that buys up local TV stations and then dictates to them what their content should be. It's a very hard right, you could even say alt-right corporation. It's run by the family of the founder, whose name was Julian Sinclair Smith. It was run by his son David until last year. David had his run-ins with the law, but they have been pushing a very hard right line for a long time. They are very close to Donald Trump. They promote a lot of fake news stories. They have a scary segment about Muslims that basically is designed to promote Islamophobia and pushes a lot of phony stories. They attack other broadcasting outlets and news outlets as being deceptive. I mean, I could go on and on, but Right. Basically they're a corporation. They're a propaganda outfit.
So, you know, when I first got into radio, and I've been in radio my entire adult life, I actually have a degree in broadcasting that shows this has been my career. And I had to take broadcast law. And I remember, and a lot of the rules have changed since the old days. But back then, the rule on ownership was one company could own 7 AM, 7 FM, and 7 television stations throughout the country, no more than one of each in a single market. Well, obviously that's changed. Now Sinclair, so there used to be a lot of like mom and pop companies that owned, you know, television and radio stations. And the thing is their influence only went so far, because if you could only own 7 of them, there's no worry about a broadcast monopoly. I remember warning back in the days of, you know, following Berlusconi and seeing how he rose to power in Italy. And I remember saying, he who controls the media controls the government. And here we are now at a time when there are really very few ownership caps. I mean, Sinclair Broadcasting now owns, I think you write in your piece, 193 television stations, and they're waiting on approval for their buyout of the Tribune Company, which would bring the number up to well over 200, right?
Yeah, I think it's 173 now.
Gotcha.
If they buy Tribune Media, it will be 220. There will be many, many markets across the United States where the only local news is Sinclair Broadcasting. So, the world is so different. You've heard the statistics, and I'm sure you've talked about them on your show, that we had more than 50 broadcasting companies 25 years ago. And now we're down to 6 and probably less major media companies. So there are a lot of reasons to be worried about this. You know, historically, whenever a revolution happened, the first place the revolutionaries would go is to the radio or TV station to take it over. And then if there was a counter-revolution, the army took it back or whatever, that's the first place they'd go. So there's a reason for that, because people still, even in this age of the internet, I think they have a reliance, a certain kind of person does anyway, on television news, mm-hmm. and they give it a credibility that they may not give a random meme on the internet.
Right. And there's a difference between now Fox, and I hate using Fox and News together. It's just, it's their name. It's not an accurate description of what they do. In fact, I have a bit that I play that I've been playing for years, long before Donald Trump started calling the mainstream media fake news.
Your original source for fake news. Fox News. We make shit up.
So, you know, we know Fox makes shit up. They've done it. They've been doing it for as long as they've been around. But Fox is a different animal than what we're talking about with Sinclair, because Fox is one channel. It's one cable channel that, granted, has a huge reach. Its audience is pretty enormous, although it has been falling in recent years, I think, because they've been dying off. Sinclair is different because it's a bunch of individual local TV stations scattered throughout the country that all, and what Sinclair controls in terms of local programming is what they brand as news. And it's not really news in many cases. It's more opinion, but they call it news. Doesn't that run afoul of the FCC rules?
No, it doesn't anymore. And one of the problems is that now we've got an FCC that's very friendly to Trump and very friendly to Trump's allies. But, you know, one of the things that, at least with Fox, which is, a horrible outfit, but at least with Fox, people by now know what it is. And they know that if they're turning on Fox, they're, at least a lot of people know, they're kind of Republican, they're kind of this, even if they're not really savvy on media issues. The real problem, one of the real problems with Sinclair Broadcasting is that they don't know the same thing about Channel 4 News. They just know it's Channel 4 News. But they don't know that their Channel 4 anchor, you know, the man and woman they see every day that lives in their community or whatever, is being told what to say by these wealthy people in Baltimore, Maryland. So, for example, all the anchors were ordered during the news section of the program to read out a statement as if it was their own at every single Sinclair station that says, we're extremely proud of our quality journalism, but we're concerned about the troubling trend of irresponsible, one-sided news stories plaguing our country. And then it's a whole rant about how mainstream media are fake news. And then get this, it ends with a very Fox statement. We know that truth is neither politically left or right. Our commitment to factual reporting is the foundation of our credibility, which is exactly what Fox started out doing. We report, mm-hmm. you decide, no spin zone. But it's almost subliminal. You know, it's secretive. It's this corporation acting in secret to try to influence what people think. It's fake news, but it's on this TV.
It's gaslighting to the nth degree, because they're telling people, everybody else, what they're doing is fake news, but we're giving you the real deal here, even though what they're giving you is a pure opinion piece as pushed by the corporate owners of this television station.
Yeah, and I another example they'll have You can see them on YouTube. They have this series called Terrorism Alert Desk. And when that comes on, you know, there's this kind of blast of, like, you know, the kind of music that you play in, you know, we interrupt this program for a special broadcast, and they'll say, Terrorism Alert Desk. We've learned that in Europe there are parts of cities that no one can go if you're not Muslim, and you know, Sharia law prevails and all that. Totally false. Or there is suspicion that XYZ Muslims have done this. So it's literally just a segment devoted to stirring up hatred and fear of Muslims, and all their stations are ordered to carry it.
They also have they have scripts that their anchors have to read, like the one you referenced, but other, I guess, sort of like editorials, except they're couched in words that make it sound like this is a news story that they're reading. They also have prepackaged pieces with people like Boris Epstein.
Yeah, Boris Epstein, you know, his whole thing is kind of, how do I say this nicely? It's kind of like a special program for broadcasters, because I literally, everything else aside, look, you know, I hate Rush Limbaugh, I hate Bill O'Reilly, but they are, in their own ways, talented at broadcasting. Boris Epstein has no talent for broadcasting, but they like what he has to say. They like his right-wing opinions. So Sinclair affiliates are ordered to carry Boris Epstein. And remember, by the way, lest we forget, that it was Sinclair in 2004 who was going to air a quote-unquote documentary that totally distorted John Kerry's war record, and was going to do it right before the election. Mm-hmm. But we had a better FCC then, and they made them moderate it a little bit. But that's the kind of thing they wouldn't carry Nightline, because Ted Koppel devoted one episode of Nightline to reading all the names of the soldiers killed in action in Iraq. And they wouldn't carry it because they didn't want people to be reminded that Americans, much less Iraqis, were dying in Iraq, because they wanted to suppress that news. I mean, they are a propaganda outfit, pure and simple.
You know, it's also dangerous because oftentimes many of these stations are affiliates of networks. They could be ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox affiliates, or some of the other. I looked up Sinclair Broadcast Group. Their website is sbgi.net. And on there, you can get a list of all their TV stations, and it'll tell you, you know, the network affiliation. Some are the CW, some are Univision, but people who tune in and see the ABC Nightly News or whatever they call it, World News Tonight, might think, well, this is an ABC station. It could be an ABC affiliate, but still owned by Sinclair, giving people this misplaced sense of ease, like, oh, this isn't them, because they're ABC or NBC or they're mainstream media. Well, no, it that has nothing to do with who owns the station, what their network affiliation is. Do they?
No, you're absolutely right. That gives it a legitimacy.
Yes.
That even Fox doesn't have, and that is very dangerous. That's a great point, Nicole.
So right now you said they own 170 some odd stations. If this merger with Tribune goes through, it's going to be 220. This has been in the works for a while now. Do we know, is there a time table on it? Do we know what's happening with the merger?
You know, I actually don't know the timetable off the top of my head, but I think we can assume that it's going to go forward, unless something dramatic happens.
Right.
You've got Ajit Pai, who's a Trump and big media friendly person running the FCC. You've got Jeff Sessions running the Justice Department. It's very unlikely something is going to happen to stop it. So that's what we're looking at.
That's pretty frightening. There's another big merger that's also, I guess, before the FCC, which is the AT&T Time Warner merger that we're waiting to hear on as well. So there, but this is a very merger-friendly FCC.
Apparently, you know, it's interesting. They're balking at the merger that involves a China-connected company, but by and large, they are merger-friendly. We haven't seen, but Nicole, this country has been astonishingly merger-friendly for a number of decades now through both Democratic and Republican presidents. We've lost the understanding somewhere along the way of the problem of monopoly, whether it's media monopoly or other monopolies. So we're dominated by monopolies now. That's one of the reasons why cable service is so lousy and the companies jerk their customers around so much. Comcast is infamous for that. So in all sorts of corners of American life right now, we've let monopolies get away with murder and we've let them proliferate. One of the things that actually encourages me a little bit about the political dialogue now is that at least in the Democratic sort of policy world, people are taking it more seriously as an issue. And I think that's really important because I think that while the right wing loves to talk about how our freedoms could be taken away by government, our freedoms are being taken away by big corporations.
That's true, but in a situation like this with Sinclair, there's really no way. I mean, I sound the alarm all the time, and again, I saw your piece at ourfuture.org about Sinclair, and I thought, let me get Richard back on the show to talk about this because it's so important that people know. But even if they know, there's still not a whole lot they can do other than don't pay attention to the local news, which is something that, I've been doing for a long time now, because local news is an animal in and of itself. With, if it bleeds, it leads. Local news is not the highest height of journalism. But people,
it's also pretty racist. If you look at some of the studies about how they cover a black crime versus white crime, the proportions and the kinds of, or even if a black person is a victim of a crime but has been convicted of a crime or arrested in the past and released, the arrest picture, they'll run with the arrest picture. There are all sorts of issues with local news for sure. And to your point about, people can't do anything, sadly, I couldn't think of anything people can do when I wrote this piece. But I do think, of course, that people can start asking candidates and elected officials tough questions about where they stand on monopoly in the media and monopoly power in general. I think we need to make it a political issue.
Right, and start paying attention to who owns the media, near you, whether it's your local TV station or radio station. Again, there's a handful of companies that own them now, so it's not that hard to do. But it's getting out there and making sure people understand what it means that, yes, your local TV station isn't locally owned at all. It's this company out of Maryland that is this right-wing behemoth that makes its anchors read these hostage video statements, that push a worldview on the viewer.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no question about it. They even look, they mistreat, news is a profession. You and I know that. Mm-hmm. And news people are professionals and should be treated as professionals, but they are so abusive toward their journalists. For example, the former CEO, David Smith, the son of the founder, was arrested on a prostitution charge. And I won't go into the details, but it involved a moving vehicle and recklessness in that regard. And he made his journalistic staff do his public service work. He was sentenced to public service to broadcast certain kinds of stories. He made them do his community service for his arrest.
Wow. You know, there used to be a requirement in the public file that stations were forced to keep. I don't even know if they have to have a public file anymore in a local studio that people could go and visit and ask to see. They would have to show how they address local issues of importance. I'm drawing a blank now. Ascertainment, it was called. Someone from station management would have to go out into the community to do ascertainment, to find out what the top 10 issues that facing the community were, and then have to show how their programming dealt with those issues. I think all of that goes away. There used to be some local ownership regulations. All that is gone.
Right.
There's really no recourse that a viewer has other than to turn off the television.
Right. And that's why, again, the best activism we can have, I suppose, is to press our elected officials and maybe write letters to the local newspapers, too, saying that this is a Sinclair station, they're misleading people, and, you know, try to draw attention to it in some way so that people in the community know what it is we're looking at. Because here's the statistic for you. Once this merger goes through, nearly 70% of all American households will be getting a Sinclair station.
Wow. Wow.
That's as close to, you know, near monopoly dominance as you can get. And granted, a lot of people don't watch local news all the time, but, you know, many, many of us have it on at least part of the day. Maybe we're waiting for the national news, or we want to catch up on the weather or whatever it is. I guess you can do that on your phone now. But people do turn on the local news, mm-hmm. a lot of people.
Yes.
And it's influential.
Yeah. And so it's a good practice to be aware of who is dictating the programming. And again, when a local station, if it's a network affiliate, it's going to look like any other ABC or NBC or CBS station out there running all their primetime shows, where it's evident who owns the station is in that local news time. And it will say, you know, copyright Sinclair Broadcasting, or whatever company owns your local station. And so it's good to be aware of who these directives are coming from, and to know when you can turn it off.
Yeah, oddly enough, there's a sort of analogy with the funeral home industry. Many funeral homes in this country are owned by the same corporation whose name I'm blanking on right now. But when they buy a funeral home, they keep the original name. So if it was Eskow and Sons, and it was Eskow and Sons for three generations, they'll call it Eskow and Sons. You don't know you're not dealing with a local business.
Right.
It's the same with Sinclair Broadcasting. It's very, very disturbing.
It really is. So there's a bit of a public service feature from the show here. Beware of who is out there. And when you hear something portrayed as news, it used to be one of those FCC regulations was you couldn't call it news unless it was a bona fide news report. The way Fox News got around it was they were cable, and cable didn't fall under the auspices of the FCC. But local broadcasts did. But I guess those rules have gone the way of the fairness doctrine. It just doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, and they're continuing to shave rules off as they go. Now, there is still a slight limitation. There's a percentage-driven limitation on the number of stations that can be owned. So Sinclair, to go through this deal, is offloading maybe two or three stations in order to get the 220. But the way they're doing it is they picked big city stations like Chicago. They're going to drop the Chicago station. They're going to sell it. And my personal suspicion is they're doing it for two reasons. One, you can get a lot better money mm-hmm. for a big city station. Mm-hmm. But two, the demographic is not, those aren't their persuadable
right.
people. I think they're in it in order to influence the politics of this country under, you know, subversively. And if you want to influence the politics of this country, let's face it, Republicans and Trump candidates are never going to run Chicago. So you sell Chicago. because right. that's not your market. Mm-hmm. You go into swing cities, swing states, and Republican leaning, and you push your message there. To me, that just confirms what they're trying to do.
Absolutely. So smaller markets and rural places that are more likely to be red states or red cities are more likely to have one of these stations in them. Anyway, you can Google Sinclair broadcast stations and you can find a list and see which ones are near you, just so you know what you're dealing with. Again, it's better to be informed. At least that's the least we can do.
Yep.
Richard Esko, you had a piece that you published yesterday at ourfuture.org. I've seen it all over the place at Alternet, on Raw Story, where they didn't give you credit, by the way, and a few other places, called Pete Peterson's Ghost. And I somehow missed the fact that Pete Peterson died. I guess I could be a bigger person and not say good riddance, but I'm not that nice. So Pete Peterson died. Why do I not care that he died? Why am I not sorry?
Why are you not moved to tears?
Yes.
Here's why. Because Pete Peterson was a billionaire who probably spent $1 billion in his lifetime trying to build support for the idea that government needs to be cut back. We need spending cuts. Government deficits are, in Pete Peterson's world, the most important thing to worry about, and were even when in the midst of the financial crisis of 2008, that we have to cut Medicare, cut Social Security. He pushed politicians who hewed his line. Pete Peterson was kind of this invisible, to the general public, invisible figure who changed the political discourse way for the worse. He threw money out right and left. He promoted Republicans, a whole bunch of he was a Republican himself. He was in Nixon's cabinet as Commerce Secretary. Mm. He was one of the first hedge fund billionaires. He was an early pioneer of a lot of really bad Wall Street practices, not criminal, but predatory, exploitative, right. And he took that money and spent decades pushing these destructive ideas, and he did it in ways big and small. For example, Barack Obama gets elected president in the midst of the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression, immediately appoints a deficit commission, not a jobs commission, right. Not an anti-poverty commission, a jobs commission, a deficit commission. Composed almost, in terms of the non-politician members, almost exclusively of Pete Peterson people who'd been on the Peterson payroll. There's a whole flotilla of Republican and Democratic consultants and economists who have benefited from Pete Peterson's financial largesse. He would put on these things called the Fiscal Summit every year, where Bill Clinton would come. Bill Clinton, he was an early backer of Bill Clinton and really influencer of his thinking. Bill Clinton would be the big draw, and you'd have Clinton and John Boehner being treated like a statesman. Paul Ryan, who's the biggest effing phony to ever come down the pike, would show his, I call them Potemkin PowerPoint presentations, because there's nothing behind them, but everybody said, oh yeah, he's smart. He would do that at the Fiscal Summit, and they treat him like he was somebody brilliant. Mitt Romney, when Barack Obama said in a debate with Mitt Romney, that I suspect on Social Security, my opponent and I think very much alike, that was Pete Peterson's doing. When Martha Raddatz, in a vice presidential debate, you know, ABC's Martha Raddatz said Social Security and Medicare are going broke, that was Pete Peterson's doing, because he put on a lot of seminars, gave a lot of talking points to news people, hired a lot of very well-known news people to chair his fiscal summits or chair debates there. When I went, I saw Dana Bash and John Harwood, and the list is long. So he did so much, and then he did a lot of dumb things that didn't do anything, but he had so much money to burn, it didn't matter. Like, you know, one of his campaigns was the bad politician, a phony bad politician who likes to spend money, and his name was Hugh Jidett, J-I-D-E-T-T-E, get it, huge debt. My counter proposal for a billionaire named Hugh Jidett never took on, never gained quite as much momentum either. But, you know, he had these, he tried to get millennials. One thing he succeeded in doing, I think, is convincing millennials that Social Security won't be there for them when it will. And we need to expand it and make sure it's strong. But, you know, trying to convince them it won't be there so that they don't support it. And he tried all sorts of, the can kicks back was trying to get young people to cut their own Social Security. It was a weird idea. Third Way, the Wall Street Democratic think tank, mm-hmm. those guys came out of an earlier Pete Peterson young people program. I mean, this guy, his fingers were everywhere, and he was not doing good things.
How did he get so entrenched in with the Democrats? I mean, that's what I don't understand. Obviously, he was a Republican. He has had Republican values. He wanted to kill the New Deal programs. He wanted to kill Social Security and Medicare. Why did the Democrats embrace him?
One, he had a good pitch. No, I'm really trying to save Social Security by cutting it. And two, he wrote big checks. Yeah, I mean, you know, come on, you know, big checks are very attractive to a certain kind of politician. And he really pushed this idea that I'm not liberal or conservative. I'm just concerned about the math. In fact, he tried to get me fired from the Huffington Post, which shows how little he understood about the Huffington Post, because I kept referring to him as a right-wing billionaire. And he kept, I'm not right-wing. His people would write me, he's not right-wing. He supports Democrats and Republicans. So, okay, I wrote back, name one liberal position, left-wing position he's taken on something, and I'll stop calling him that. And so then they went to Arianna Huffington and said, you have to get rid of this guy. So, of course, for 10 years, I've been writing right-wing billionaire Pete Peterson, partially to get even, but partially because these were traditionally right-wing ideas that he just managed to sell as if they were politically neutral, but they're not.
One of his goals was for means testing of Social Security and Medicare and other programs. Does this live on post Pete Peterson?
Sure. I mean, when Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders were debating and she said, you know, I don't want to give free college to Donald Trump's kids. Well, you can use that argument to say, I don't want to give free high school to Donald Trump's kids. I don't want to give clean water to Donald Trump's kids. Some things shouldn't be means tested because they are a public good. They are something that you deserve by dint of being a human being who lives in this country. And but that idea of means testing, which is at the heart of everything Pete Peterson tried to do to Social Security and Medicare and everything else, it really, really is pernicious, really undercuts the social contract that we all live by.
Means testing Social Security, I mean, I look at it as this is they're earned benefits. Same thing with Medicare. We pay into it all these years. Am I looking at it the wrong way?
No, not at all. And when you start saying, well, Social Security should be cut, but it should still keep people out of poverty, well, anti-poverty programs are good and they're important, but that's a different thing. That's a different social goal. Social Security was meant to be universal. It was meant to be that you pay this in, you get that this much out. That is social insurance. You know, that is protecting, that is paying in for a known benefit down the road. And when you start undercutting that, you start really robbing the program of what makes it strong, and you start down this road, well, we'll just cut a little bit for really rich people. Pretty soon you're down the road, you're cutting it for everybody. And if you think rich people are getting a free ride, raise their taxes.
That's a pretty good idea. I wish I would have thought of that. Raise their taxes. That's not going to happen until we change the government. So just thought I'd throw that in there as if people didn't realize that anyway. Richard Eskow, find him at thisisthezerohour.com. That's the Zero Hour is the name of Richard's podcast, which is based at We Act Radio in D.C. I'm going to put links on my blog today along with today's podcast of this show to the two articles we talked about today. Richard, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. I can't thank you enough for joining us.
Same here, Nicole. Always a pleasure.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye. Ah, and with that, yeah, there's always a lot to think about, right? There's with the Sinclair stations. Again, my solution is I don't watch local news, but you know, if you have to watch it, just take everything with a grain of salt. And if something sounds like an opinion, know that it is an opinion. It's not fact. All right. With that, we're done for the day. Tomorrow is Thursday. Howie Klein is on vacation this week, so Dave Johnson will join us. Not sure what we'll talk about. We'll see what happens in the news tonight, if another shoe drops or not. We'll see. Regardless, I'll be back tomorrow. As always, thank you for listening. And we'll be back tomorrow. NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.